will, I'll have a hit or two of weed. Mm-hmm. And then I watch, this is so weird. Right now I'm really into, interrogation videos.
Where like, yeah.
Like police stuff.
Sure.
It's fascinating what people do and say when they're on the spot. I think that's it. Like, I just, because I've always had this, allergy to being in trouble.
Sure.
That like, it's just, I don't know. I love just watching, see what people who are in incredible trouble do.
That's great. You
know, like the quick thinking they have to do. Yeah. Like it's, I don't know. It's fascinating to me. So I don't know what it says about me. In my life, I hope I lie and tell everyone you were a good wife, and I hope you die. I hope we both die.
Hello and welcome to the Adulting Well podcast. I am your host, Pepper. I am joined, as always, by Kevin McCracken. Kevin, how are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. As I said, I'm in my office, which is rare these days. And our guest on the show is John Worster, which has me like really excited for a variety of reasons. You know, not to mention Superchunk, Mountain Goats, Bob Mould, but John, you've played for two of my all-time favorite bands ever, which are Rocket from the Crypt and Guided by Voices.
Oh.
I mean, like, really, like, crazy fan. Like, make my wife go with me to see Rocket whenever they're
here. Oh, wow.
And scream along.
Kevin, who are we just talking to that was talking about the Rocket from the Crypt, Craig Kilborn fiasco?
Rich Egan.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. So I think he was doing some work with them at that time. But, you know, so I just, you know, I really want to just start this off with, you know, thanks a lot for coming on the show. It's a like honor to have you here. And, you know, given your resume and your history, especially in music, but also writing and your comedy work and your voice and sort of on-screen acting. I mean, I kind of got to ask before we get too far into it, like, what in this lifetime do you actually aspire to at this point? Like, what would be your ultimate thing? I mean,
that's a question I ask myself often. it's such a weird thing to say, but I kind of did what I hoped I'd do already. Like when I was a kid, I sort of, you know, I had these dreams of pretty much doing what I've been doing. So I have no complaints, but I also ask myself that, like, what do I want to do next?
Yeah.
And I guess it's just kind of keeping doing what I'm doing. And I got so lucky that, you know, I fell in with all these bands and I met Tom Sharpling and we found our way in the back door of the comedy world. And so I don't know what's next. I'd like to just keep doing what I'm doing and seeing if any other doors open, which they usually do. It's really interesting. Like out of the blue, I'll get an offer to be in like a TV show or something,
right?
Play on, nice. Play on a record. And I love stuff like that. I love the things that just kind of come out of nowhere.
Gosh, and I want to Chris Farley this interview so fast right now, but instead you mentioned that as a kid, you know, you're pretty much doing everything you wanted to do. I would like to learn a little more about what that kid was like. Like, what kind of kid were you? Were you an inside kid, outside kid, lots of friends, no friends?
Both. I had a lot of friends in school early on, but I had a very rich inner fantasy world also, which I guess a lot of kids do. So, you know, my fantasy was, you know, was always to play music and be in a band and stuff. And
did you like music when you were young?
Yeah. I the first concert I ever saw, and it honestly didn't make a huge impression, but it's still my first concert, was the Carpenters when I was,
oh wow.
When I was, I think five or six. Six. It was 1972, at the Allentown Fairgrounds in Allentown, PA. And, I loved watching drummers, you know, because a drum kit is almost like a hot rod, you know what I mean? To a child, it's like a thing, it's like a spaceship almost. So it's very, it's very impressive optically.
You almost get in it.
Yes. So I just loved watching drums and the drummer and that sort of thing on American Bandstand or whoever was on TV. And that was what I think it really caught my eye and my ears when I was around 10 or so. And my parents got me a little drum kit when I was 12. I started taking lessons when I was 10, just for like 6 months, but it was so unsatisfying. You know, you get a little drum pad and that's it, really. So it's like, this isn't drumming.
Sure.
And so I was really into sports too early on, like until I played baseball and football and things like that, track. But then when I was 14, I got in my first band. And that was called Hair Club for Men. So this is 1981. And the bass player was a couple grades higher than me. And he played bass. So I was a ninth grader in junior high school, and he was already in high school. His name was Steve Grass. He was a friend of my brother's. And the other two guys were adults. The other bass player, because you have to have two bass players. one to play fuzz and one to play regular.
Okay.
So he was 28. He was like a real man. And the singer was an adult too. So it was a very odd mix of people. And, you know,
did you play shows?
We played in local VFW halls.
Yeah.
We didn't play. I was too young to get into a club. So we didn't do anything like that. So that's kind of, you know, where I was as a kid. And I had friends who also liked music. But you know, my tastes were pretty out there. You know, by the time I was like 13 or so, I loved the Clash and the Ramones and the Police and that sort of stuff. And I grew up in like a small farm town, about 35 miles outside of Philly. So not a lot of punk rockers or new wave aficionados. So,
Were you watching a lot of, TV too? Like, where did the comedy come from? Did you watch SNL and stuff like that?
My favorite was Second City TV.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. That was my favorite. And that's what Tom Sharpling and I really bonded over. We loved that. And, you know, to this day, we still talk about it all the time. And just, you know, it was such a formative thing because those early SCTV sketches or bits, they're really long. Like there's not a lot of payoff in quite a few of them until, you know, something major happens. So that's what a lot of our best show work has been. Like it's a slow simmer and then finally something funny happens, you know, several minutes in. So I think we both were influenced by that approach to comedy.
It's funny.
And you're willing to say the audience needs to be a little more patient or needs to invest a tiny bit more than.
Yeah. And our first several years on the show, people were very, not upset about it, but like, they were like, they wanted instantaneous comedy gold, you know, and it takes us a while to.
Laughs per minute.
Instant gratification in the United States of America.
That's all there.
It's funny because I the same guy that introduced me to the Dead Kennedys introduced me to SCTV when I was in junior high.
And
I always thought SCTV was sort of the thinking man's comedy or the thinking person's comedy. And then they shortened it up for Saturday Night Live to make it more sort of accessible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's funny. I just want to go back to the younger you, because you grew up in a small town, right? Like you weren't in like a major metropolitan area.
Not where I lived. I lived, you know, kind of in the middle of nowhere, but we, you know, we're getting, all the Philadelphia radio stations and TV. So I was definitely aware of what was happening. It was nowhere near my fingertips, you know, at that age.
So how did that kind of develop? Because you were, I mean, you and I are pretty close to the same age. I'm 52, or I will be in a month. And, you know, I lived in a pretty small town that Pepper lived in as well. But And we had to like mail order everything. And it was just like a process. You know, there wasn't like that. We had a great record store. I will say that our record store was probably one of the best record stores still that I've ever been to.
Oh, wow.
But
where's this?
Santa Rosa, California. So
oh, okay.
Up north,
45 minutes north of San Francisco. Yeah.
Oh,
but
okay.
But it was you know, it was a small place. So how did kind of all this, you know, and I don't want to call it like alternative, but kind of, you know, like punk and different musics and the comedy, like where did you get those influences from? I'm really curious about that.
Well, I was just, I would read a lot of these music magazines as a kid, like Cream and a great one called Rock Scene that was out of New York in the mid to late 70s. And that's kind of where I found out about punk. And at that point, it's funny that there's a documentary on Kurt Cobain that's based on these interviews that Michael Azarad did with him. And I can't remember what it's called, but Kurt in there says pretty much what my experience was, where I would get these magazines that had punk rock in them, but I had no access to hearing the punk rock. So I just kind of like had to make up my own little version of what I thought it was, you know? Nice. And then finally a friend lent me the first Ramones album and I loved it. And there was a great syndicated TV show that we got in Philly called, God, what the fuck was it called? It was called Rock World. It was a Canadian show called Rock World. And so we're talking 80, 81, and they would have videos by The Clash and The Ramones and The Police and bands like that. So it was like, oh my God, this is what I love. So I was lucky that music really just spoke to me and connected with me. And, you know, I just loved it. And so that's how I got into that. But I still lived very far from a record store. You know, like I couldn't, I would have to, my dad would take me or awesome. You know, my mother would take me and I would go buy. I remember the first money I ever made playing music. Hair Club for Men had a show at a VFW. And I think I made like $60, which was a lot of money for a kid. And I spent it all on records. I remember buying the Heartbreakers live record at Max's, Iggy Pop live TVI, a few other things. Plasmatics, New Hope for the Wretched. I just loved all that stuff. But it really kind of drove a wedge between me and my best friends when I was 13 or 14. They weren't into that stuff at all. And they really kind of stopped wanting to hang out with me after that. It was very interesting.
You were getting too weird.
I guess so. Yeah. Or just, you know, they were getting into pills and things.
Like, okay. Yeah.
Things that I didn't approve of.
Sure. Sure. How'd you get out of that town?
I was really lucky that, I'll try to make this as short as possible. A band that would open for Hair Club for Men at the time, so 81 or so, was a band called Narthex. And it was a duo who were from near us. And the drummer was a guy named Dean. And Dean went on to be Dean Clean, the drummer in the Dead Milkmen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So Dean didn't live super far from me. I mean, like it was a drive, but he would let me come over and hang out with him and the Dead Milkmen when they practiced in his basement.
Oh, so, that's so cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, I owe so much to those guys for just kind of letting me hang out with them.
Sure. And
now I'm like 16 or 17. And so I'm getting to kind of hang out with them and go into Philly and go to shows with them too. So, nice. So they would take me in to see who all these great bands, you know, Government Issue, Minor Threat, who else did we see? The UK Subs.
Wow.
Circle Jerks. So all that stuff. Yeah. So
how old were you at this time?
I still wasn't driving yet. So I was probably 16.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So that was really, those guys were a very important, you know, thing for my formative years. Absolutely.
Cool.
Well, so talking
about... Wait, so that got you out of the town?
That got me into the city, at least. And through that, I met a couple of friends of theirs who were looking for a drummer, and that band was called Psychotic Norman.
Oh, you drummed your way out of town.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. but so I joined this band called Psychotic Norman, and now we're talking 1980... God, I must have just graduated high school, so it was 84. I remember I graduated on a Friday, and I started work at a toothpaste packaging plant factory on Monday. Like, so I had no,
sure.
why I didn't have a wild weekend. And it was the night shift too, so I started in at midnight.
Here's real life.
yeah. So no plan to go to college at all. I did end up going to a recording engineering school in Ohio in the summer of 85. And so
was that helpful for you? That
absolutely. In that it made me realize I liked playing more than I liked being on the other side of it.
Right.
Sure. So
right.
I had plans to maybe be an engineer or something, but sure. I realized I like playing more than that. Yeah. I'm so glad I went because it gave me a little bit of, know-how.
Sure.
So through the Dead Milkman, I meet the Psychotic Norman guys, and we made a single that came out. It barely came out. I quit. I left the band before it came out, but we had some good gigs, for about a year. So we're talking like 80, 84, 85. We opened for the Minutemen a couple months before Dee Boone died. That was amazing.
This is Philly.
Yes. Yeah.
Thanks.
De Kreutzen, great band from Milwaukee, Suicidal Tendencies, stuff like that. So, that was really fun to play those shows. But so we had a little problem with our bass player. Our bass player was an incredible bass player, but couldn't always be relied upon. And we'd practice at his house.
That's why you need two.
Exactly, yeah. So this is not Hair Club anymore. This is Psychotic Norman.
Sure.
One bass player, but we practiced at his house. And we played a gig at a frat house on a Friday night. So now we're talking January of 85. And we practice every Tuesday and Sunday. And it's Sunday, and I go to his house. It was quite a drive, too, for me. I was still up in the farmlands. And we'd practice right outside of Philly in Upper Darby.
Sure.
And he doesn't show up at his own house for practice. And the night before, my brother, who was living in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, on a track scholarship, he calls and says, I met this band and they're looking for a drummer. And I was so kind of annoyed by the bass player not showing up at his own house that I got home that night and my mom knew about this too. She goes, your brother called again. And I said, I think I'm going to do it. And so I called my brother. He gave me all the info, and it was a band whose record I had sent away for in my last year of high school. They were called The Right Profile. They were like a jangle rock band from North Carolina. And I loved all that Mitch Easter produced power, pop stuff.
Sure.
REM, DBs, Let's Active.
Yeah.
And so I end up, my dad gives me money for a flight on Piedmont Airlines. And I go down and I audition and I got in the band somehow.
Wow.
They were called The Right Profile. Never put a record out.
But wait a minute. Hold on. There's some trivia in this one, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So I'll let you just tell it because I'm a fan of this man that you're going to mention.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So the band consisted of a bass player, Tim, a guitar player, Jeff, and this other guy who played guitar and keyboards and accordion named Stephen J. Dubner. And Stephen would go on to great fame and success as a co-writer of the Freakonomics books.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to hold up my phone for proof or anything, but I subscribe to his podcast.
Oh, great. Awesome. Yeah. I was on his podcast once and the topic was quitting. and so we talked about his quitting, which we'd never really discussed, for probably 20 years.
Amazing.
So I get in the band and I move from Harleysville, PA down to Winston-Salem, and I'm 19, and I'm in a band now. And we get signed by Clive Davis to Arista Records about 4 months later.
Amazing.
Which is crazy. Like, I'm in a toothpaste packaging plant one night, and then within the year, I'm in Clive Davis's office signing a record contract. It was so bizarre. And then that went to shit pretty much immediately. But we did start a record with Jim Dickinson.
Okay.
And he had just produced Pleased to Meet Me by The Replacements. And so that was incredible. That was an incredible experience.
What an amazing person to get hooked up with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because that record is just
killer. Oh, yeah. And we did it right where they did it too, and there was vomit stain still on the wall from when they threw up, and it was great.
That's amazing. So when you got up there, you're 19 years old. I mean, like, was that the point at which you were just like, I'm just doing this? Like, I'm like, fuck it,
well,
I'm in.
I had no other I think my book might be called No Plan B. because there was no plan B. And it never entered my mind that this wouldn't happen. And I was so whatever naive. Well, I remember when I was like 15 or something, or even younger, saying, if I don't make it by the time I'm 20, like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I signed this record contract at 19.
Yeah.
So I was lucky to get all my horrific music dues paid pretty early on. Like, basically, we get signed and we just spent forever submitting demos of songs, and they didn't hear a single, and they were sending us, no lie, outtakes from Slippery When Wet, a song called You're Not My Lover, But You Were Last Night.
Wow.
And we were like a roots rock band. Like, we sounded kind of like Exile on Main Street, Stones, Meets.
Okay.
Meets, yeah. Pleased to Meet Me, sort of. That kind of thing. And the band. So it was not, that was not our scene. And long story short, we ended up getting dropped. Really tough times, you know, poverty. And so we get dropped in like 90, I think. Mm-hmm. And we sign a publishing deal, and this woman who signed us to our publishing deal wants to get us in the studio with Steve Jordan. And okay. Steve Jordan is, right now he's on the road on the drums with the Rolling Stones.
Oh, okay.
And, he was the drummer in David Letterman's band for years, and, produced a Soul Asylum record, John Mayer. And, so he's starting to become a record producer now. And our A&R person wants us to record with him. And so we end up doing it. We go up to New York and we get out of the car. And the first person we see as we get out of the car is Stephen J. Dubner.
Oh, you got to be kidding me.
I swear. And I don't even think we saw him at first because he looked like a businessman. I think he had like galoshes on. And we hear this voice go, "Hey, fellas." And it's him. Just on the street. It was so bizarre. Anyway, so we end up recording with Steve Jordan just for like 4 days. And it was the most important 4 days of my musical life. He was just.
How so?
Oh, he was just amazing. He never showed me what to do or how to do anything. We basically would go to his apartment and kind of play around, and he had a little drum kit there and some amps, and it's like 2 a.m. and he owned the whole floor. So no one was complaining. He probably still lives there too. And,
just to get a feel for the songs and
yeah. Yeah. And huh. I don't recall him ever even sitting down at the drum kit. So right. I would just kind of soak up whatever his vibe was.
Right.
And then we went into the studio, this great place called the Hit Factory, where I think like the River and, you know, big records like that were done.
Sure.
And so he's producing, and this guy Nico Bolas is the engineer. Nico had just done Neil Young's Freedom album.
Okay.
And have you ever seen this clip of Neil Young on SNL doing Rockin' in the Free World? It's the greatest thing ever.
No.
It's insane. It's Steve Jordan on drums, Charlie Drayton, who's now Bob Dylan's drummer on bass, Poncho from Crazy Horse on guitar, and Neil. It's like punk rock. And
oh, wow.
So we recorded with Steve probably just a month after that, and I got to use that drum kit. It's just an amazing vintage drum kit, and it was just this magical experience recording with him. It's like, it was crazy, and the Berlin Wall was coming down that week, so it was it was like everything at once. And then I got done my stuff, and Joe Strummer was playing at the Palladium. That I think it was a Saturday night, so I'm done finally, and I had no money. Like I really had like $5 probably.
Sure.
And I'm an adult.
Yeah, I get it.
And so I'm talking to Steve, and I go, man, I'd love to see Joe Strummer. I wasn't fishing or anything. And he goes into his wallet, and he gives me like $30.
Nice.
And he goes, go. And so I took the subway down to the Palladium, and I saw Joe Strummer. I was second row. Yeah. Incredible. It was better than when I saw The Clash.
Wow.
And Xander Schloss from the Circle Jerks on guitar, Jack Irons from Pearl Jam, Chili Peppers on drums, Lonnie Marshall, only guy I've ever seen play a Steinberger bass that wasn't awful. Shirtless.
Wow.
So good. Anyway, so I guess I bring that up because that week was just like, I'd love to see like what my astrological stuff was going on right that week, because it was like, sure. Yeah. So nothing came of this recording session other than it being such a huge event in my life. Like we never had a record deal. We ended up kind of, we did a final Death March tour out to LA in the late summer of 91. And I at this point I'm a window washer here in Chapel Hill. I moved to Chapel Hill where my brother lives. And so now it's late summer of 91. We get back. I have $2 to my name now. And I go visit my brother. My brother at this point is he's an album cover designer for local bands here in Chapel Hill. And he goes, hey, Mac from Superchunk called. And I was like, please, need a drummer. And he did. And so by chance, I was the window washer at School Kids Records where Mac worked. And so I go in and we talk a little bit. And he said, basically, they're having an issue with their drummer and they're going to go out on this tour with Mudhoney in a few weeks. They're going to see how it goes. But in the event it doesn't go well, would you want to play drums? So he gave me a copy of what was going to be their next album called No Pocky for Kitty. And so they go on the tour and I'm doing my window washing and I'm listening to the record all day long. And I loved it. It was really great. And they came back and they played the release show for No Pocky at the Cat's Cradle. And they were really good. Like they were so much better than when I last saw them, because they've been touring a lot. And it turned out it wasn't working with the drummer. And so I remember going to see Nirvana. Nirvana played at the Cat's Cradle.
Oh, rad.
And I went there, and I don't even know if I'd met Jim, the guitar player, by this point. I'd met Laura at a Danzig show at the Cradles not much earlier. And so my memory is that was kind of the night where it was like, I think you're going to be in the band.
Okay.
And I saw 7 Nirvana songs and thought that was okay and left on the Nevermind tour. So,
oh my God. When they kept upping the size of the venues that, you know.
Oh, it was a crazy night. I remember going there earlier that night to visit with some friends of mine who were in the opening band. They were called Das Damen. Mm-hmm. And I remember going in and it was just such a bizarre feeling. It was total dead silence. Each guy from Nirvana was in a corner of the Cat's Cradle doing an interview, like with different people. And you could just sort of tell something was happening.
Uh-huh.
It was pretty interesting. And then, so I joined Superchunk. Our first tour, we played a show in Bloomington, Indiana, and we go in the venue for sound, to load in. And there's this frat band. Like, these guys were frat guys.
Oh, wow.
Capital F.
Yeah.
And they're playing Teen Spirit.
Oh, wow.
Like, that's where they practiced. And I was like, okay, this is changing.
Yeah, it's a thing.
When I was in high school, there was a talent show, and the band that won was a bunch of frat boys playing Teen Spirit.
Yeah. It's wild. Like, somehow it was pro and metal enough.
Yeah,
to attract those guys.
It was so crazy. I mean, when that album came out, I lived in Santa Rosa, but we had a lot of connections to the Pacific Northwest at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
I was playing in hardcore bands, and we would go up there and play. And a friend of mine, like, I used to book all of Slim Moon's bands when they would come down, you know, because no one else would book them. And we had this studio that we could do shows in and this small space. And I mean, who the hell was doing shows for, like, you know, Kill Rock Stars and K Records at that point? You know, I mean, Santa Rosa, California, of all places.
Yeah.
So we got a pre-release copy of that record. And I remember listening to it at a party, and all of us are looking at each other going, like, these guys are no longer going to be a band we're going to go see at Gilman Street, or, you know what I mean? It was like, the record was so polished and so good.
Yeah.
And it really is a good record. I mean,
I can
laugh about it now and the frat boy shit, but it's, I mean, that record was, you know, it was amazing. And it's just funny to hear because I kind of forget about that time. I try to actually block it out a little bit, because I was one of those, like, don't sign to a major label guys, you know? And,
yeah, you were hardcore.
But it's interesting hearing other people's, like, versions of what was going on then, you know, and I just want to kind of call that out. It was an amazing time in music, really.
Oh yeah. No, yeah. It was like, you know, for me, having been through that major label, you know, disaster is too heavy a word, but it sucked. It was not fun. It was not good. It didn't get anywhere. To go into this world where, oh yeah, you can put your own records out.
Yeah.
Like Psychotic Norman did, you know? Yeah. And it was so great, because it was like, oh yeah, you can just go on tour now. You don't have to submit demos to anybody. You don't have to do any of this stuff. You just do it. And that was so great. And like I said earlier, I was so glad I had this terrible experience first, you know, because it really made me appreciate everything that came after.
Because the brass ring was no longer the brass ring anymore, right?
Yeah. No. I'd already been on a major, so I knew that it had 90%, you know, chance of being awful. And for 90% of those bands that signed it, probably was, except for if they were smart, like whoever, they bought a recording studio, you know, that they're still using now.
Yeah.
But I think that those stories are probably few and far between.
Sure.
Yeah. Most of the people like either they basically got that advance and never saw another penny and blew it.
Yep.
And you know, and I think, you know, I'm standing here, I've got the Jawbreaker poster behind me. They're a great example. I mean, they just, you know, until the recent comeback, you know, they had that disastrous, you know, and Adam used to say, you know, basically it's the same old story, you know, poor guy gets rich and then he gets poor again, you know?
Yep.
And so that's what a lot of bands went through during that time. I mean, how amazing is it though, that you were the window washer at the, where Mac was working at the time, and kind of what that ended up being for all of you guys? Cause that band, like, their trajectory after you joined, like, completely changed. I mean, the records after, you know, after that, the record that you didn't record, which was, I guess, No Pocky, is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're amazing. They're amazing records. I mean, one after another. And I mean, I saw Superchunk play at smaller venues. And then I saw you guys play at, like, Treasure Island Music Festival out here.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's just like, to see that band who, I always appreciate bands that are super talented, really good musicians, but also play music that's accessible. Because, you know, I mean, you can be a good musician and play stuff that's just like, it's so mind-blowingly hard to listen to that, you know, it just sucks, quite honestly. But it, you know, you guys are all super talented, but it comes together in such an amazing way. And I mean, I guess kind of delve in a little bit about all, you know, about Superchunk and how that's kind of shaped your other bands. Cause now after that, it was just like, it was on.
Right. I was really lucky that I had experience in a couple different worlds. Like I loved punk rock. So when I joined Superchunk, I could, you know, I could talk about that, and I could play that pretty well. But when, you know, when I would get asked to play with other people, I also had that right profile, roots rock, whatever, trad stuff in my bones too. So I was able to kind of, I was able to do maybe more things than someone that was just one, you know, had one wheelhouse, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, I was really lucky with that where, you know, over the years I've gotten to record or play with, you know, so many, I can't believe it. You know,
yeah.
Nick Cave, Guided by Voices, and
wow.
REM and New Pornographers and all kinds of stuff like that. So it's I love it. It's what I was hoping I'd be able to do. I was hoping I would be able to like be in a band, have that be kind of the mothership, and then do whatever.
You use the word, John, you use the word lucky a lot and luck a lot, but I think you're a really humble person because obviously you were practicing drums in there somewhere. And obviously you're someone that shows up for band practice on time and things like that. And you don't put on airs when you talk. So I think it's not just luck, right? It's like you worked really hard and that's part of it. You were available.
Yeah. Yeah, I worked really hard, but I was also like, so many times I was just in the right building at the right time. Like this Nick Cave thing I mentioned, I was out in LA, Fred Armisen and Bill Hader asked me to be in this show called, Documentary Now.
I love that show. Yeah. So oh, much. Yeah. Yeah. I love it.
So it was a spoof of Stop Making Sense, the Talking Heads film. And they did a fantastic job. It looks just like it.
It's so
and,
good.
So I'm the drummer in their band. And, so we went out to the Valley to shoot the concert and you do it twice. And, so we did it once. And then during the break, Hal Willner, the great, you know, music supervisor, producer from SNL, et cetera, he had a speaking role in the show that's, unfortunately, didn't make it in the final cut, but he was great. And he comes up to me, and I'd never met him before. And he goes, "What are you doing tomorrow?" And I said, "Well, I'm flying home to North Carolina." And he goes, "Would you wait?" And I said, "Yeah. What's happening?" And he said, "I'm producing this session tomorrow at Village Recorder, where you know the Steely Dan records were done, and I think some Stone stuff was done there." And I said, "Oh, who are you producing?" And he goes, "Nick Cave, Courtney Love, and Maria McKee, who was in this great band called Lone Justice." And I said, "Yes." And T-Rex covers for this T-Rex. I think it's going to be a documentary about Mark Bolan. The album already came out. The album came out maybe a year or two ago. Mm-hmm. But and so I go to the studio and it happened and we did it. And it was like, he came in the room and it's like, "Oh my God." Like that's like, that was probably the most Elvis moment I've ever had where, "Oh my God, those are the pants he wears. That's it." Like, just like,
yeah.
And do you keep it pretty cool?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I kept it extra cool because my memory is it was almost the year anniversary of his first son's death.
Oh wow!
So I just thought his guy's probably in a, and he was like, you could tell he was still, you know, recovering from that. And, but it was like, plays the piano. That's him, sings. Just like the voice is there. It's just crazy. You just can't believe you're in the same room as it.
You really are the Forrest Gump of,
I guess. Yeah. And then like, this is crazy too. I was kind of friendly with this guy named James Walburn, who's the guitar player in the Pretenders and has been in there for a long time. And, I didn't know him super well, but he invited me to come see the Pretenders down in South Carolina. This is about probably 5 or 6 years ago. And I go down and because it's the middle of nowhere, I'm the only person on the guest list. And so I get to go back and I'd never met Chrissy or Martin and they were so cool. They were really funny. And maybe 3 months later, James reaches out about would you want to play in the band for this one-off show that we're doing in Western Massachusetts?
Nah.
It was like a private gig. It was like, yes. And so Jason Narduzzi and I from the Bob Mole Band and Superchunk, we got to be in the Pretenders for a night.
Wow.
And we played the songs you wanted. It was just amazing. And she was so great. And
how do you prep for that?
The most I've ever rehearsed for anything because I wanted it to be great.
You put headphones on and just play along to their songs?
Yeah, all day, every day. And, okay. And
there it is.
And this is a great lesson if there are any players out there. My huge fear was that I was going to lose the beat on Tattooed Love Boys, which is the song that's on the first album. And it's got like it turns over. Like it's like, whatever, four bars of eight and then a seven in there. So it's, you got to count, which I'm not, I take great offense when someone brings in a song that does that.
Sure.
But I was lucky that the one song that I love that has this thing to it is Tattooed Love Voice. But I was really terrified of fucking that song up live. And so I must have rehearsed that, my poor neighbors. I must have rehearsed that 500 times before we played the show. And so we're sound checking, and I did fuck it up.
Oh, no.
Yes, but I recovered so quickly. And it was the best thing that could have happened because it proved to myself that if I did fuck it up, I could get out. I could get back, like, in a second.
Sure, sure, sure.
And so I would recommend fucking up to anybody.
Yeah.
Whatever you're doing, because it'll show you how you can get back in, or you can get out of it, or it's not that big a deal. So
we used to call it getting the suck out, you know.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Suck in practice so that you can hit that shit when you're live, like, you know, perfectly. I think, you know, I know it feels like we've been talking for like 5 minutes, but it's been 40 minutes already. So I just, like, there's a few things I really want to get to
before we
jump off. And, you know, one of the things is Bob Mould. And so I was at the Noise Pop show at Bottom of the Hill when you guys played Copper Blue in its entirety.
Yes.
And I'm just going to say, I've been to, as you can probably tell, probably thousands of shows at this point. I don't even know. I can't count because it's just ridiculous. And it was probably the loudest show I've ever been to in my life.
I would not doubt that.
The sound man that night is a guy named Paul Thomas, who was covering the board. He's the lead sound guy at Bottom of the Hill.
Okay.
Known him forever. He let me stand in the sound booth for part of that set. And I have a video of the needles on the board and they're buried. And he looked at me at one point to check to see if I had earplugs in first. And then also between songs said, this is the loudest show we've ever had at Bottom of the Hill.
And it's
not even close.
Was anything coming through the PA except vocals?
Just vocals. Wow. You guys didn't need much anything else. I mean, the guitar was so loud.
Yeah.
And the I mean, just everything on that stage just jumps anyway.
Yeah.
So it was incredibly low. But on the other side of it, it was also crystal clear. It was one of the best sounding shows I've ever been to because I've seen him play. I actually saw Sugar play. And I've seen him play acoustic, and I've seen him with you a couple of times. And his shit always sounds like, it's like, you know, it sounds right. It's just good.
Oh yeah. He's a singular guy. Amazing.
How is it playing with him? I mean, how did that even get asked to do that? And how did you not freak out? Because I printed the shirts for that show too. Cause I had a screen printing company and I dropped them off and it was just Bob standing at the bar.
Yeah.
And Ramona was there that owns Bottom of the Hill.
Yeah.
And they're having a chat and they both turn and look at me and I know her, but he goes, oh, you must be Kevin, the merch guy. As soon as he said my name, I got like butterflies.
Yeah.
You know, and then I left and came, I actually came back because I said, you know, I got to say this. I spent 3 years in high school in Michigan and Husker Du's music and your lyrics specifically saved my life when I was there. And he was, you know what he said to me? Like completely straight faced. No, he said that hearing stuff like that never gets old. Thanks for telling me.
Yeah.
It's but Kevin, if you had kept your cool, he would have asked you to be in the band.
Never know.
Yeah. So what, I mean, how did that come about? Cause
I first met, like, I was always a massive Husker Du fan. Like they were in my top three when I was a teenager and they probably still are, but, My ex at the time, Angie, and she, Angie was in Let's Active for a long time.
Okay.
She ended up, this is, God, I don't know when this would have been, probably early 2000s. She was a publicist for a label called Yep Rock. Okay. And they did one album with Bob called something of Body of Song.
Okay.
And so I met Bob through her at the record release show for that record. We went up to DC when he was living in there. He was living there to go to this record release party. And I remember bringing up my Zen Arcade and Flip Your Wig, and he signed them. And then I saw him play live at the Cat's Cradle. On his first band solo tour since he stopped playing with the band. So right. We're talking, I don't know what this would have been. Oh, three, maybe? Mm-hmm. I don't know. But Jason Narduzzi is the bass player in the band.
Okay.
Brendan Canty on drums from Fugazi. And Rich Morell on keyboards. And so Jason and I soon after that end up being in Robert Pollard's band.
Right.
The Ascended Masters. So we did about 9 months of touring when Pollard put his solo records out on Merge Records.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm in the Mountain Goats by this point. Now we're up to like 07, 08. And Mountain Goats are doing a tour of the U.S. And we have an Australian tour coming up. And John has to cancel the tour for some reason, John Dorneil. And we have two dates left, Philly and DC. And in Philly, I get a call from Jason Narduzzi, who is now out with Bob Mould on a tour for his album called District Line.
Mm-hmm.
And they're having problems with their drummer. And he goes, would you be willing to do this European tour that we have coming up with Bob? I said, absolutely. Because I had nothing coming up. And then he calls the next day and he goes, would you be able to finish this tour?
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And by chance, we have one more show left with the Mountain Goats in DC. And I say, I'm feeling lucky. Let's do it. And so I said, just send me what the songs are. I already knew a lot, most of the Husker Du songs. I knew a lot of this, you know, workbook songs from the solo records and that sort of thing. And I knew some Sugar stuff. And we finished the Mountain Goats tour. They dropped me back off here in Chapel Hill. I think I flew out to LA maybe that night or the next morning. And they picked me up and we drove down to Solana Beach in outside of San Diego. We sound checked and we played our first show that night.
Wow.
Wow.
So there wasn't time to be nervous about anything.
Yeah. You son of a bitch, I'm in.
Yeah. we're doing this. And to this day, it's like Chuck Berry. I watch Bob's right foot.
Yeah.
And when he stamps it, that means the song is going to end in a couple seconds.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So he's got to tell he should not be a Major League Baseball pitcher is what you're saying.
Exactly.
They know when that fastball is coming.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. That's so funny. So the other thing I wanted to get into was your writing and acting stuff, because it, you know, you haven't been as active. It looks like you, because you're playing in so many bands right now.
Yeah.
And what are your plans for that? I watched a couple recent interviews and listened to a couple recent interviews. Sounds like you're going to do a book at some point.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, you should. I mean,
I don't really pursue the acting, but things will come up every now and then. Like I auditioned for a role on Barry. Bill Hader thought I would be good for this thing. And
nice.
I think I might have gotten it, but I couldn't do it because of the touring.
I saw all of it. Yeah,
It's the guy who is the coffee shop owner last season.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So I auditioned for that, and
yeah. I could see that.
That would have been fun. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So yeah.
Things like that come up. I got asked to audition for the. I guess there's some sort of animated Better Call Saul prequel.
Oh, wow.
That's coming up. I didn't get that, but...
that's fun, though.
What about the writing stuff? Are you doing any writing for any shows? Or
not lately. Tom and I, you know, I still do the best show every Tuesday night when I can. And that's like writing an episode of comedy every week. So
sure.
So
that sounds fun.
I consider that a job, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it's incredible that you guys are still doing that after still all these doing years. It.
Too. Kevin, like, can I ask a stupid question? Just yeah. one stupid. I never asked anyone a stupid yep. question yeah. yet. Is Katy Perry cool? Because I just love her on American Idol.
She was great. And I honestly didn't know a ton about her other than she had that song called I Kissed a Girl when we
sure,
had,
sure.
did this thing at the MTV Movie Awards in 2009, I think it was. And she was great. Very, I mean, she's...
That's it. Say no more. Say no more.
Yeah, she had the vibe of a star even then.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
You know, so... Yeah. And I got to play with Joe Perry from Aerosmith on that little gig.
Awesome.
And
oh, that's awesome.
He was cool. So, yeah, it was just.
I just saw that little blurb in Wikipedia and I was like, I got, what's yeah. what's up with that?
She was great.
And I said, we met and she goes, you look familiar. And I just said, oh, I've been around. That was it. And we never talked again. But
okay.
That's a pretty good comeback for somebody yeah. who's now as famous as she is.
I've been around.
Yeah. So what that's not a dumb question, by the way, Pepper. If I noticed the Katy Perry thing, I would have asked too. I find her to be a very interesting, compelling character. So what's on the horizon? What tours you got coming up? Tell us, give us all the rundown. We're going to throw links in the show and all that stuff.
Well, I'm not sure when this is airing, but I'm going to go out to LA on Sunday and we're going to do a 24-hour straight best show next Tuesday.
What?
I have no idea what it will be like, but it's going to be 24 hours straight. So,
that do you sleep crazy. Anyway? I mean, is it, do you get any time?
I'm sure I could. Like, yeah, it's not going to be just me the whole time. Okay, so I'll be able to do that. But Mountain Goats have a new album coming out.
Awesome.
In about a month, I think, and it's called Bleed Out.
Okay.
And we're going to do a big tour for that starting the end of August, and that's the big thing. A couple more Superchunk shows coming up. Big festival in Atlantic City in I think September 24th with Rocket from the Crip.
Are you playing with them at that?
I'm not playing with them. No.
Are you playing with, who are you playing with?
I might shake a little tambourine. Superchunk.
Nice. Yes.
Oh, rad. God. Rad. That's a rad show.
Yeah, that's a lineup right there.
I think GBV's on that show too. I think.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
You could do triple duty.
I could.
That's a lot. So what do you do for yourself? Like when you're not, because this is obviously, you know, it seems like you love your job, but it is still work. I mean, how do you tell us before we go, tell us how you relax? Like, what is your thing? How do you kind of unplug?
I'll have a hit or two of weed. Mm-hmm. And then I watch, this is so weird. Right now I'm really into, interrogation videos.
For like, yeah.
Like police stuff.
Sure.
It's fascinating what people do and say when they're on the spot. I think that's it. Like I just, because I've always had this allergy to being in trouble.
Sure.
That like, it's just, I don't know. I love just watching, see what people who are in incredible trouble do.
That's great. You
know, like the quick thinking they have to do. Like it's, I don't know. It's fascinating to me. So.
That's all my wife
says about me.
That's all my partner watches. So great. I get a lot of it in my ear, but yeah, it's fascinating stuff. There's one called Signs of a Sociopath, I think, on HBO. Yes. That's a good one.
Okay.
Oh, and Body Behavior Experts. I love that.
Too. Yeah. Because you see them, look how he's fidgeting. You know, he's, yeah.
Self-soothing. Like that's one. They're self-soothing.
Totally. Oh my God. That's so funny. Well, I just want to thank you. This was like as good or better than I expected. Thanks for coming with the stories and the energy and, you know, just being you and all the work you've done. And, you know, I think drummers oftentimes get such a bad rap having played drums in a lot of bands over the years. And, you know, you give us a really good name. So I want to, from other drummers, I just want to thank you as well.
Yeah. The drummer is always the wild card.
Yeah.
Always. I agree.
Always.
So, well, we appreciate having you on, and when we're getting ready to air it, we'll send you some social media stuff if you do any of that stuff. So
great.
All right.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on. It was great meeting you.
Thank you guys. Vacation 40 years old today.
Yay. Wow. Okay. I'm putting it on as soon as we're done. Go right. Vacation, everybody.
All right. In my life, I hope I
hope you die. I hope we both die.